This is Audible.
Novel Audio presents The Actor's Life, A Survival Guide by Jenna Fisher. Read for you by me, Jenna Fisher. With Rainn Wilson, Mark Brooks, Natalie Z, Sean Gunn, Derek Waters, and Reed Burney.
The Actor's Life, a foreword by Rainn Wilson. When I first met Jenna Fisher at the callbacks for The Office in late 2003, I was struck by her integrity, her passion, and her attention.
Sorry, Mr. Wilson, we already have an introduction.
Wait. Excuse me? What?
We already have an introduction. We were told you were just reading it. This one by Steve Carell.
Wait. Wait, this? Seriously, you want me to read this? This introduction written by Steve Carell?
Yes.
Well, why can't Steve read his own introduction? This is insane.
Yeah, I just can't. I don't know what we're going to do about it. Mm-hmm. All right, okay.
Oh, he's too busy writing his future Oscar acceptance speeches. I get it. Okay, fine. Fine, if that's what Jenna wants, that's what Jenna gets. I will... Fine, I'll read this. Okay, here we go. So, I don't know, take two or do whatever you need to do over there. Foreword by Steve Carell, read to you by Rainn Wilson. This makes zero sense. When I was a kid, I wanted to be either a zookeeper or a fireman. Later on, as I matured, I decided that I would operate a crane. As my crane dreams faded, they were supplanted by my bulldozer phase, followed closely by my backhoe period, and finally, my dump truck passion. By then, I was 6 years old and knew that I had to stop playing around and commit to something practical. Acting. Granted, there was a brief period between ages 15 and 22 when I thought I'd become a lawyer, but that madness faded quickly and I decided to pursue the noble art of thespian miserism. But how? What's my first move? What sort of things should I know? How do I prepare myself? Is there any source of practical information on how to approach a career in acting? Does the woman who played Pam on The Office have any honest or thoughtful advice? Yes. Yes, she does. I first met Jenna Fisher in 2004. We had both been cast in the pilot of the U.S. remake of The Office, a critically acclaimed BBC show. Jenna was quiet and sweet, and within moments of our first meeting, I knew that she was also a terrific actor, completely present, detailed, and subtle. She was effortlessly funny, and she possessed something that I always admire in actors. She never seemed to be trying too hard. Week after week, she would find complexities to her character, Pam. It never became routine or stale. I also admired the way in which Jenna could play wonderful nonverbal moments. There's a scene in season 3 when my character, Michael, shows up at Pam's art show. Jenna played it with such a delicate touch. She conveyed sadness, pain, joy, appreciation, and love. Silently, in about 45 seconds. She's an extremely deft, intuitive actor. I spent 7 years with Jenna on the show, and the quality of her work never wavered. I also admired her professionalism. She always knew her lines, was always on time, was a great ensemble player, and her hygiene was impeccable. I'm looking at you, Rainn Wilson. Wait. Seriously? Seriously. Oh, man. Okay. All right, continuing. This book is an excellent reflection of Jenna's talent, her work habits, and her dedication to acting. Reading this book was, in many ways, like retracing my own career path, although, unlike Jenna, I did briefly dabble in the sex industry. I'd like to hear more about that. She relates lots of good advice, from choosing headshots to finding an agent to preparing for an audition. Nuts and bolts stuff that every actor has to learn at some point. She also examines the psychological and emotional toll that the journey can take, facing rejection, accepting failure, and keeping a positive mental attitude are covered in a very frank, honest way. I completely related to Jenna's personal journey. Crappy apartments, inventive low-cost food options. Mine was rigatoni with Prego. And the ever-present skepticism of friends and family. I still remember the bemused and slightly pitying looks I received at my 25th high school reunion. I told my old classmates that I'd just co-written and starred in a movie called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. There is a certain resolve that a person must have to persist at something that seems intangible at times. Jenna's book gives a roadmap for navigating the road that every actor has to take. I just want to say that that's just a weak sentence. The book gives a roadmap for navigating the road that every actor has to take. Seriously? Repetitive. Okay, continuing. I wish that I had this book when I was starting out. Perhaps I would have made something out of myself. In all honesty, it would have made life a lot easier. Is that it? Where's the rest of it? Wait, that's it? Are you kidding me? That's it. I came all the way. Okay. I just want to say to this recording studio, whoever you are, the producers, the sound engineer, and to Ms. Jenna Fisher, that this is complete and total bullshit.
For Lee, Weston, and Harper. Introduction. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. When you grow up in a place like St. Louis, saying you want to be a professional actor is the equivalent of saying you want to be a professional surfer. Not very realistic. But apparently, no one ever told me, because as early as I can remember, I had big dreams of being an actor. In grade school, I got my start when I played Toto in The Wizard of Oz. In case you're not familiar with the story, Toto is the dog that belongs to the lead character, Dorothy. It was a role that nobody else wanted. I guess the other kids couldn't find the value in playing the dog. But I didn't care. I liked dogs. Sure, I didn't have any lines, but I had lots of stage time. See, Toto was on stage every time Dorothy was on stage, and Dorothy was the lead. So I was always right next to the lead. I did funny little dances with the Munchkins and barked at the Wicked Witch. Who needs lines when you can ham it up as the spunky sidekick? Then in high school, I played Fiddler in the musical Fiddler on the Roof. This was another role that no one else really wanted. But hey, my character opened and closed the play up on that roof, and without the Fiddler, it would just be called The Roof. At some point in my formative years, it dawned on me that an acting career wouldn't happen in St. Louis. There were only a handful of movies filmed there during my entire childhood. Among them, American Flyers, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and, for you trivia buffs, Escape from New York. But the idea of moving from St. Louis to Los Angeles, La La Land, or New York, the city of broken dreams, was daunting and scary. Hollywood in particular seemed like a million miles away, almost like another country with its own customs and currency. And if I was able to somehow get to Tinseltown, how would I even begin to break into show business? I didn't know anyone. No fancy connections. No idea how the business worked. I'd heard stories of girls being discovered at the mall. Did that mean I should go shopping more often? I'd heard that most movie stars had that special it quality. Did I have it? Not likely, since my proudest acting moment was playing a dog. I'd heard about a stand-up comedian being offered a starring role on a hit TV show. So that's the secret. Should I start doing stand-up? Actually, I tried stand-up once. The lesson I learned was to sit back down. Nonetheless, after college, I collected my theater degree, packed up my Mazda 323 hatchback, and, along with my cat Andy, started on the long journey from St. Louis to Los Angeles. I arrived in L.A. on a typical California day. The sun was shining, the sky was blue, the palm trees were swaying in the breeze. I pulled off the 101 freeway and drove into Hollywood. It was my first day in Los Angeles, and everything felt perfect. Then, nothing happened for 6 years. Well, some stuff happened, a lot of which you'll hear about in this book. But 6 years is how long it took before I was finally earning a living as an actor. 6 very long years. 6 years of crying and accumulating debt and living in crappy apartments. 6 years of small successes followed by heaps of rejection. And it would be 2 additional years before I landed the role of Pam Beasley on The Office. 8 years then. 8 grueling years before I'd get my first big break. During all that time in the trenches, I wished I'd had a mentor to give me advice. Someone who could put the whole daunting experience in context. Who'd been through the heartache, the tears, the rejection, and made it through to the other side. Because while being an aspiring actor can be difficult, it can also be inspiring. There's a unique and personal awareness that comes when you're forced to dig deep, look honestly at yourself, and question your artistic resolve. And now that I've been through it, I've realized that the struggle is a natural part of the process, the profession's unique way of testing your desire and creativity. But amid all the confusion and rejection, it would have been helpful for me to have someone to pump me up, put things in context, and pass along relatable stories. So, if you're an aspiring actor, and I'm guessing you are since you're listening to this book, I'd like to be that person for you. I had a teacher who used to say, if you can think of anything you're passionate about besides acting, do that. Your life will be better for it. And while it might sound harsh, I actually think that's very good advice. I didn't follow it because I couldn't think of anything else to do. If you're like me and can't think of anything else either, then this audiobook is for you. And, as your newly minted mentor, I'm here to tell you that you've made a noble choice, because acting is a worthwhile pursuit. I can't tell you how to make it. I can't tell you if you will be successful. But I can encourage you, and hopefully, make the journey slightly more enjoyable. So, let's get to it. Good luck. I have faith in you. Chapter 1. Getting Started. The miracle isn't that I finished. The miracle is that I had the courage to start. John Bingham. I'm in Buckinghamshire, England, lying in a meadow, surrounded by fire and wreckage. My plane has just gone down in a spectacular crash landing. Bits and pieces of the plane are scattered all around me. The passengers of the plane all seem to be alive. It's 95 degrees outside, and I'm wearing an orange polyester prison jumpsuit covered in dirt and blood. Black smoke is everywhere. I'm lying here, looking at the sky. A herd of sheep saunters by. Okay, this isn't real. I'm an actor, and this is the scene of the day. The fires are real. The sheep are real. The dirt and blood are not. When I first walked onto the set, I couldn't believe my eyes. The wreckage from a full-size jetliner was strewn across the field, fires burning all around. According to the script, my job was to get into a broken seat and pretend I've just crash-landed. So I did. And as I reclined back in the seat, I couldn't help but think about what a crazy, surreal life I'm living. It's hard to believe that I'm a working actor. Not only was I fortunate enough to spend nearly 10 years shooting an iconic American television show, but now I'm living in London with my family and working with stunts and fires and car chases and this big airplane crash. I feel like an action star. I'm so lucky and so grateful I have to pinch myself. I did not grow up in a showbiz family. My parents weren't actors or musicians or writers. My father was a plastics engineer, and my mother was a school teacher. Both are now retired, but they both loved what they did. My mom says she always felt she had a calling to be a teacher, and it showed. And if you've ever seen my dad pack a suitcase, you can immediately tell that he was meant to be an engineer. Both of my parents were able to build careers doing what they love, and I feel like their example rubbed off on me. From a very young age, I inherently knew I had to follow my bliss. While I knew I wanted to be an actor from the time I was a child, I was not a child actor. I went to dance class, I joined the theater club and put on little shows in my garage, but I never acted professionally. The bulk of my childhood acting experience came as a result of auditioning for school plays. These auditions mostly ended in failure. I never got the lead roles. In fact, I barely got the supporting roles. I usually found myself being offered the obligatory consolation prize, a role in the dancing chorus. Needless to say, I didn't grow up with a gaggle of people convinced I was the next big acting sensation. Of course, in hindsight, my old theater teachers are happy to discuss my obvious talent from a young age. I'm still close to many of them, and I find it hilarious when they tell me how they saw something in me. Yeah, you saw me in the dance chorus. But somehow, being stuck in the chorus didn't damage my resolve to give it a try professionally. In fact, it probably emboldened me. I knew I had to give it a try. No matter how difficult it seemed, I was determined to make it as an actor. But why did I feel this need to try? Why did I want to be an actor? At the time, I never gave it a second thought, but this is an important personal question, one that I think every actor should ask themselves. And by the time you finish this book, I believe you'll know my answer. But what about you? This profession is very demanding, both as an art form and a business, and will most likely require years of dedicated struggle. So, as you make your way through this book, I challenge you to ask yourself the same question. Why do you want to be an actor? I can tell you off the bat, if you're chasing fame and money, you're likely to be disappointed. Even if you aren't, even if you are doing it for the love of the craft, you are likely to experience discouragement. The journey to becoming a working actor, meaning simply, an actor who makes a living through acting, is a long and difficult one that requires a lot of hard work and perseverance. But it also requires something more obscure and out of your control, luck. Without a little luck on your side, you can be the most talented actor in the world and not achieve success. That's the hard truth about this profession. I have a friend who's been acting for more than 20 years. He's a very talented, classically trained actor, always very memorable and funny in whatever role he plays. He's not famous, although he does get recognized from time to time. But after literally hundreds of amazing performances, he still doesn't make his living from being an actor. He's still a full-time waiter. Another friend of mine has been earning his living as an actor since he was 19 years old. He's now in his 40s and unknown to the general public. He does theater, on and off Broadway, movies, television shows, living basically paycheck to paycheck. Sometimes he has a good year, like the time he landed a season-long role on an award-winning television show. Sometimes he has a bad year, like the time he did a low-paying independent film with an acclaimed director that ended up never selling at the festivals. He's not rich, he's not famous, but he works and earns his living exclusively from acting. He loves it. With most careers, the path to success is laid out for you. There's a clear set of advancements and promotions to strive for. If you're great at the job, you get rewarded. If you show up and work above and beyond everyone's expectations, you are pretty much guaranteed to move up the ladder. Not so with acting. There is no justice in our business. No pecking order for advancement. So then, why does it work out for some and not others? A heavy dose of luck. When I landed my role in The Office, I had been a poor, struggling, unknown actor for 8 years. I worked hard, sure, making ends meet from job to job, but other actresses were out there working just as hard as me. I had talent, they had talent. But then, suddenly, I had luck. When Pam came along, my particular set of attributes and talents aligned perfectly for the character. I was the right person at the right time for the right job. But that's not the extent of my serendipity. If you think about it, if Ricky Gervais had never met Stephen Merchant and created the original British version of The Office, or if some executive in the States hadn't decided to make the American version, or if the casting director hadn't thought to bring me in for an audition, or if NBC hadn't decided to pick up the show after we made the pilot, I would probably still be out there pounding the pavement, looking for my next three lines on Law & Order. The fact is, I got very, very lucky. Before I moved to Los Angeles, I thought the life of an actor seemed easy. And now, years later, I am telling you, it's not. It can be rewarding, inspiring, magical, intense, terrifying, consuming, passionate, and unique. But it is not, and will not, be easy. However, just because something is difficult doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. If you love acting, if you have a gift for acting, you should go for it. If you feel you have a talent to share with the world that is meaningful and important, you must give it a try. I believe there are steps you can take to gain an edge on the competition, and there are ways to increase your chances of being lucky. I will discuss many of these throughout the book, but in this chapter, let's talk about the very beginning steps of your actor's life. Training. I believe the most important thing an aspiring actor needs is training. I graduated with a BA in theater from a tiny liberal arts college called Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri. Kirksville is a college town. It's small and safe. You can walk everywhere. It's far enough from my hometown of St. Louis that I felt separated from my parents, but close enough that I could drive home on the weekends if I wanted. I got a great education, and I didn't leave school with a giant debt. Theater school was awesome. In one class, we sat in a circle and gave one another shoulder rubs. I'm not kidding. Massage trains were part of the curriculum. Best kept secret about becoming a trained actor. I also did exercises like stand in front of the class and roar like a lion, or move through space like a squirrel. I did a scene where I repeated the same line over and over with different intentions. These exercises might sound silly or pointless when you hear about them, but trust me, they turn you into an actor. We worked on voice, movement, breaking down a character. We read tons and tons of plays and did tons and tons of scenes. Memorizing lines became second nature. Theater school provides you the opportunity to be cast against type. When I was a senior in college, I got cast as the middle sister Meg in Crimes of the Heart. She's the boozy, slutty, chain-smoking bad girl sister. I would never get cast as Meg in the real world. I would either be cast as Lenny, the type A older sister, or Babe, the wide-eyed innocent baby of the family. But a good teacher knows that the purpose of theater school is to push you out of your comfort zone. So I was cast against type and played the wild girl. It was awesome. I went totally method and smoked cigarettes the whole semester, wore Daisy Duke cutoffs, and went a little crazy. I loved doing that play. Did I look ridiculous? Maybe. Did anyone believe me as this character? Who cares? I had a blast. My school didn't have a film and television department, so in order to make films, a bunch of us from the theater department rented video cameras. We wrote, shot, and edited our own projects. Our biggest hit was a satire of NYPD Blue that we called KPD Blues. It was a comedic spin on the then-popular TV cop drama, but it was also a send-up of the local Kirksville Police Department. The episode ran on the closed-circuit college TV station that broadcast to the student center and the dorms. The station was normally reserved for the broadcast of debates and school sporting events, but we were renegades. We were the first class to create original programming. The experience of creating my own work was probably the most valuable thing I learned in school, aside from acting technique. Being able to generate work for yourself is an essential part of the process of becoming a working actor. By the way, a number of successful actors met and collaborated in college. Christopher Reeve and Robin Williams were roommates at Juilliard. Holly Hunter and Frances McDormand were roommates at the Yale School of Drama. Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson met in a writing class at the University of Texas at Austin. From that class, they went on to make Bottle Rocket together, and the rest is history. You don't have to go to theater school to become an actor, but I believe that training is essential. You may have natural talent, which is great, but having natural ability doesn't mean you don't also need to learn acting technique. Acting is a serious craft, a learned skill that needs to be developed. If you just want to be famous, become a reality star. If you want to be an actor, study acting. So as we proceed in this book, I'm going to assume you have or will be taking acting classes or attending an acting conservatory. If you have, great. If you haven't, hit pause right now and get yourself in a class. In Steve Martin's comedy course for Masterclass, he says, I was talking to some students and they were saying some things like, how do I get an agent? Where do I get my headshots? And I just thought, isn't the first thing you're thinking about, how do I be good? So before you embark on the business end of becoming an actor, that world of headshots and agents, you need to get good. Picking the right class is important. All too often, I hear about new actors having horrible experiences with acting classes. It is my personal opinion that acting class is not therapy. You don't have to share your childhood traumas in acting class, and you should not be yelled at or demeaned by an egomaniacal teacher. There's a popular acting class in Los Angeles that recruits a lot of new actors in town with big promises of stardom. It's ridiculously expensive, the class size is huge, and you spend months waiting to perform. The rumor is you can't graduate unless you've done at least one of the following things in class. Cry, get naked, or kiss someone of the same sex. If you find yourself in a class like this, get out. Life is too short. You don't have to be abused to become a good actor, I promise. A good acting class is about stretching, learning, and discovering in a safe, nurturing environment. There should be no shaming, no forcing you into things that make you uncomfortable. It should provide you with lots of performance time and constructive feedback. Don't let a bad experience deter you from finding the right place to study. Good training is key to succeeding in this business. You will be competing against thousands of other actors who are also right for the role, some of whom have studied or trained with dedication. You want to be one of the ones who know what they're doing. Training is not just something you do when you're first starting out, either. It should be an ongoing commitment. Professional athletes train in the off-season. So should you. The big move. Unless you already live in LA or New York, you're going to have to move if you want to be a professional actor. If your goal is to be a film or television actor, move to Los Angeles. If you want to do theater, move to New York. But before we talk about the coasts, let's talk about the great city of Chicago. When I was starting out, a lot of people wondered if it would be easier to start off in Chicago. Chicago is a great theater town, and there are often film and television shoots there. It is home to some of the best comedy schools, I.O., The Second City, and the Annoyance Theater. It is definitely possible to be a working actor in Chicago. If you are serious about a career in comedy, Chicago is a great place to study and find your voice. When I was starting out, a common strategy was to move to Chicago, get some credits under your belt, and then take those credits to Los Angeles or New York. If you live in the Midwest and Chicago is an easy move for you, this might not be such a bad idea. I know a lot of actors who went to college in Chicago and were able to audition for commercials on the side. They were fortunate enough to earn their SAG-AFTRA union card this way. That stands for Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. Or maybe you will get a great theater role and get your Actors Equity card. You will definitely have an advantage if you are already in the union and have a few professional credits under your belt when you move to New York or Los Angeles. But let me be clear, there is nothing easier about Chicago. It is just as competitive as LA or New York. It may even be more competitive because there are fewer jobs and more good actors. And the winter is brutal. If you don't believe me, take a trip there in the middle of February. Being a struggling actor is hard no matter what city you're in. Today, a lot of people wonder if they should move to Atlanta, New Orleans, or Albuquerque. A lot of projects are shooting in these cities, which means a lot of small acting roles. A few years ago, the booming city was Detroit. Before that, Vancouver. Every few years, a different city passes new tax incentives, and a bunch of movies and TV shows start filming there. But then, the incentives change, and everyone moves on. If you already live close to one of these cities and you can use this to your advantage, I say go for it. Maybe pick a college that is close to one of these cities and try to get some professional gigs while you're in school. But no matter where you begin, eventually most actors are faced with the question of whether to move west to Los Angeles or east to New York. Because simply put, Los Angeles and New York are the cities with the most opportunities for the working actor. Plus, most of the major roles, even the ones shooting in Atlanta and New Orleans, are cast out of New York and Los Angeles. It isn't easy to pack up all your crap and move to a big city where you don't know anyone. But it must be done, because sustaining work as an actor starts with the relationships you build with local casting directors and producers, and to do that, you've got to be in their city. I wanted to be the next Diane Chambers from Cheers, which is why I decided to forego Chicago and move to Los Angeles. Also, if I'm being honest with myself, I wasn't sure I'd have the courage to move twice. When I moved to LA, I rented a dingy apartment in West Hollywood. This place was beyond depressing. It was interior, which meant it was surrounded by other buildings. There was leaded glass on the windows. While great for privacy, leaded glass meant very little sunlight got through, so it was dark. The windows cranked open with a rusty mechanism that sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. In short, it was a cave in the middle of the city. I lived there with a male friend from college and my cat, Andy, who found this living situation so depressing that he licked out patches of his fur. The upside of this hovel? Big and cheap. And because it was situated on the bottom floor underneath a staircase, it stayed cool. Being cool was vital to our survival because the place had no air conditioning. As for the bathroom, my visiting sister refused to shower in it because she said it looked too scary. She still calls it the place with the scary bathroom. My bedroom had stained carpet, a futon mattress on the floor, and cardboard boxes as nightstands. And that's about it. After a year, my roommate built me a wooden riser for my futon mattress using some free lumber from his theater company. It got the mattress off the floor and provided me with additional storage. If I put a comforter over the edges, it almost seemed like a real bed. Our living room had a torn bed sheet for a window covering. Classy, right? The window was next to a busy stairwell that was constantly being used by our upstairs neighbors to get to and from their apartments. A painter lived upstairs. He never left his apartment except to take his trash to the dumpster, which was outside our front door. He eventually committed suicide, probably due to lack of sunlight, among other things. Next door, there lived an obese woman who couldn't get out of bed. She had an in-home nurse, or a series of in-home nurses, and every now and then her son would visit and they would scream at each other in Russian. Did I mention this was considered a pretty good apartment? It was a central location in West Hollywood near Santa Monica Boulevard and Fairfax Boulevard. There was a laundromat around the corner, so convenient that we could walk home between the wash and dry cycles. The neighborhood was basically filled with old Russians, and it was right next to Boys Town, a.k.a. the gay section of town. So gay men and old Russians meant a young woman could walk safely by herself to and from the quick store, even at night. If you made me live there today, I would probably pull my hair out, like my cat did. But at the time, I made the best of it. Because I was young, I was in Hollywood, and I was living my dream. If you're thinking about moving to Los Angeles, some good spots for young actors to live are West Hollywood, Los Feliz, Silver Lake, Eagle Rock, and Studio City. Living in the hovel was a sacrifice, but that's what it takes when you're a struggling actor. Assume there will be no luxuries. Be prepared to get your furniture from one of three places: thrift stores, garage sales, or the side of the road. Unless you have some kind of trust fund, you will not be shopping at Pottery Barn. You will be poor, me. You will probably run up your credit cards and they will go into default, me. If you work as a waiter, you will sometimes eat food that looks untouched off cleared plates, me again. In fact, you will eat all kinds of weird things. I have a friend who ate salt sandwiches for dinner. Two pieces of bread with salt in the middle. I'm not making that up. Peanut butter was a luxury, and like I said, there were no luxuries. So if you decide to become an actor, get ready to eat like a college student until at least your late 20s. Here's a recipe to get you started. Actor's pizza. One slice of bread. Two ketchup packets. One slice of American cheese. Spread ketchup on slice of bread. Put cheese on top. Heat in microwave for 45 seconds. If you have a toaster oven, even better. Enjoy! After hearing about my experience in Los Angeles, you might be thinking, screw that, Los Angeles sounds horrible. I'm moving to New York. I love New York. It's the greatest city in the world. But just be aware that if you move there, your apartment will be smaller. I've known friends who could cook and pee at the same time because their toilet was so close to the stove. I recently saw a listing for a New York City studio apartment that had a shower in the kitchen. Not next to the kitchen, but in the kitchen. It was being listed for $1,795 a month. Will this small closet-like apartment save me money, you ask? Nope. It will be more expensive than the dingy Los Angeles cave. It could possibly be in a building with seven flights of stairs and no elevator, and you will probably share it with three other roommates. The good news, you don't need a car in New York, which means you also don't need car insurance. Right there, two LA essentials that you won't need to budget for. Plus, all of the city walking can serve as your exercise plan. No gym membership needed. It's true, some subway stairwells smell like urinals, but that's okay. You can't afford to ride the subway anyway. So if your motivation for becoming an actor is because you're hoping to be rich, change careers now. Most actors barely earn a living wage from their acting work. According to the Screen Actors Guild, the median income for a working actor is $52,000 a year. But most of the SAG-AFTRA membership earns less than $7,000 a year from acting. Only 5% of actors in SAG-AFTRA earn more than $100,000. These are just the statistics for union actors. It's safe to assume non-union actors are earning even less. But let's just pretend you earn $52,000 a year from acting. You will not bring home $52,000 a year. $52,000 of annual income minus $5,200 in agent commission, $5,200 manager commission, and about $12,600 in taxes equals $29,000 take-home pay. And so, no couches from Pottery Barn. The nest egg. If you can move to Los Angeles or New York with a nest egg, I highly recommend it. These cities are expensive. Not only will you need money for rent, groceries, phone, cable, and so on, but you'll also need money to grow your new acting business. You'll need money for headshots, more acting classes, membership fees to websites, and maybe even to help fund your own independent project. You'll need money to help you get through the poor yet working actor phase of your career. This phase can last a long time, so build that nest egg. My Diary, 1998. Please enjoy this sampling of my very real, very sobering journal entries from my early years in L.A. June 15th, 1998. 2 years in L.A. I just started a full-time job, and I am freaking out. Here I am in L.A. It's been 2 years, and I'm feeling lazy about my career. Fuck. I am so goddamn nervous right now. I'm nervous just writing in this journal. No one will ever see it, yet I'm nervous. That's probably my problem right there. I'm nervous even around myself. I judge myself too much. So I have this job to get my money situation under control, and I have a pretty good agent. But I should really be out hustling for myself, I think. I'm going to try and write. I'm giving myself an assignment to write one journal page every morning for 1 week. Well, back to work. I feel a little better. This journal is a good idea already. Plan, decide, act. There it is. June 16th, 1998, the next day. Okay, so I didn't get up and write this morning, but I did walk after work, arrange dinner, grocery shop, and paint my toenails. I really, really want a callback for this Disney cruise thing. 1 month traveling on a cruise ship. Does it get any better than that? Callbacks are tomorrow, so I'm assuming I didn't get it. So, of course, I'm reviewing everything I did to figure out why I sucked. July 15th, 1998. I get paid today. Now I get to figure out where this paycheck goes. I owe my dad $110. I owe the DMV $366. And I owe MasterCard $80. Now, I have a few choices. One, I pay off DMV completely and have a registered car. Or I pay the minimum balance due on my MasterCard, which is about $325 or so. I need to refinance this card. Let's do the math. I have $100 in the bank. I'll get paid $650, bringing the grand total to $750. Minus $360 toward MasterCard or the DMV, and minus $110 to Dad. Oh, I forgot about my parking ticket. That's minus another $51. $229 to live on for 2 weeks. I can do that. It means grocery shopping, not eating out, and very little spending. While hopeful, this is also making me anxious. New subject. I'm thinking of painting my room orange. Great, now I'm thinking about how I can't afford to. Never mind that. After college and before moving to Los Angeles, I spent a year living in St. Louis with my parents. This was the longest year of my life. The longest year. It was pretty awful going from my free-spirited college lifestyle to living in my parents' house again. Honestly, I don't think they were too thrilled either. I would get home after midnight, and the next morning we'd all pretend like I hadn't been out having sex with my boyfriend. But I'm grateful to them. They were generous enough to let me live at home and save all my earnings for my voyage to Los Angeles. I spent that year working as a secretary/receptionist in a small business that specialized in selling marine audio equipment. I made coffee, answered the phones, helped the salesmen with their PowerPoint presentations, did the filing, processed invoices, and handled customer returns. Essentially, I was Pam. The cool thing about the life of an actor is that many pointless and mundane experiences actually become important moments that you'll reference later in your career. The year I spent working at the marine audio business totally prepared me for the role of Pam. Of course, I didn't know this at the time. I was just slogging it out with bad coffee and itchy pantyhose. But it's interesting how the struggles can pay off in the long run. You may not know how, but in a magical twist of fate, what you're dreading doing today could inspire a role years from now. I graduated from college in August 1995. To avoid being stuck at home forever, I gave myself a goal. I would either move to Los Angeles in May of 1996 or when I had saved $10,000. So I spent the ensuing months working and saving. When May finally came, I had $8,000. It wasn't quite the $10,000 I had imagined, but I couldn't wait any longer. I packed my car and hit the road. I can still remember the looks on my parents' faces as I pulled out of the driveway, a mixture of fear and relief. Mostly relief that I was out of the house. I drove to LA with my $8,000 feeling smart and prepared for my new life. I completely expected to be a rich and famous actress within 2 years of moving to Los Angeles. If we're being honest, I expected it to happen within the first 6 months, but I pretended like I expected it to take 2 years so I didn't seem too arrogant. I had it all planned out. First, I would meet with my roommate's commercial agent. I figured she'd meet with me, love me, and sign me. I'd then immediately book a national commercial, which would get me my SAG-AFTRA card, plus a nice chunk of cash. Then I'd use my ace in the hole. My mom had a friend from church whose son worked at one of the top talent agencies, the William Morris Agency. He would be my movie agent. He'd take me to parties where I'd meet producers and directors who would quickly notice my obvious star quality. I'd be easy to cast because I'd tell them I could do comedy or drama. I felt sorry for all the suckers without connections like mine. Stardom, here I come. And here's the reality. After 6 months, my $8,000 was gone. I'd used it for rent, groceries, headshots, movie tickets, lunches, and a new engine for my car. I wasn't even able to afford new shoes, even though my current pair had a hole in the bottom. I remember this because it was the year of the big El Nino storm and my left foot was always wet. As far as my career plan, my roommate's commercial agent wouldn't even meet with me. My mom's church friend's son was a literary agent at the William Morris Agency, which meant he represented writers, not actors. Oops. So my plan to attend glitzy parties and wow the bigwigs was nothing but a pipe dream. Here I was, 6 months into my big Hollywood move, and nobody knew I existed. I felt cut off, confused, and alone. I cried myself to sleep more than I'd want my mom to know. The thought of quitting was constantly on my mind, probably 5 times a day. But the fact is, I was too embarrassed to go home. I'd basically told everyone I was going to be this big star in Hollywood, and I couldn't imagine facing them now. I was humbled and humiliated. But what could I do? I was out of ideas. I had done everything I could think of to network and meet people. I had asked every friend with an agent to refer me for representation, but none of the agents would meet with me. How had I hit rock bottom so quickly? What was I doing wrong? Be a joiner. When I first moved to Los Angeles, I had a chip on my shoulder. I didn't sign up for acting classes or join a theater company. My thinking was, I just graduated with a theater degree. What do I need acting classes for? So I sat on my couch reading Backstage magazine, submitting myself for countless auditions and waiting for the phone to ring. Meanwhile, my roommate joined a theater company. It seemed like all he did was grunt work, building sets, cleaning the theater, taking tickets. I thought, I didn't come here to clean up after other actors. I came here to be the actor. I was so indignant. So while I laid around the hovel, my roommate was being creative. I remember he banded together with people he'd met at his theater company, and they started writing and shooting their own stuff. He was busy all the time, constantly stepping over me as he walked out the door. My roommate was doing it right. He was living the life of an artist. Me? I was living the life of a righteous hermit. While he spent his nights and weekends in an active, thriving, creative environment, I was home, alone, watching reruns of Law and Order. I was very isolated, very self-involved. I was reading plays, working on accents, watching movies. One weekend I decided to rent every movie that Diane Keaton had ever done. All great stuff, but I was alone, and that made everything harder. I thought I was being focused. I thought I was being strategic. Listen, I was not a snob about what I would do as an actor. I was willing to shoot student films for free. I was willing to do industrial commercials. I would do a play reading. If it involved acting, I was there. What I didn't understand was the importance of participating in a creative environment on a regular basis, in finding a group of people with whom I could share a collective artistic life. My life changed when I finally found this. And the way I found this was by joining things. I volunteered to run the box office at a theater company. I joined an improv class. I took an on-camera acting class. I met like-minded artists and we started doing our own projects on the side. Sometimes I got to act in the projects. Sometimes I made the props. It didn't matter. We all wanted the same thing and kept each other busy. If you want to be an actor, you must live an artistic life. You must find ways to express your artistic life with others. Artistic lives are full of risk. I wasn't risking much by spending my Saturday nights watching John Cassavetes movies and feeling intellectually superior for having done it. Listen, I'm glad I did all that. I love that I had a year where I was obsessed with silent films, and another when I rented every Academy Award-winning movie from 1970 to 2000. Sometimes you need that stuff. You need to disappear to keep yourself from going totally bonkers. But I also know, when this was all I was doing, I was stalled. I wasn't in motion. I wasn't with other artists growing. I was on the sidelines, watching. On a very practical level, things started moving forward for me career-wise when I started being a joiner. I volunteered for a small part in a friend's showcase, and I ended up getting a manager. I joined a theater company, and an agent came to our play and signed me. But that's not why I'm telling you to join things. For now, joining things is about building up the emotional network you need to make it for the long haul. Most actors and artists are natural hermits. We hate talking to people. We are weirdly antisocial. But you've got to fight the urge to spend all day alone. Get off your computer and get into a class. Volunteer as a theater usher. Be a production assistant on someone's short film. Sign up for a 48-hour film project or 24-hour play festival. Find anything and join it. Even if you have a theater degree, get yourself in a class. Just because college is over doesn't mean you're done learning. In fact, you're only just beginning. Find something that interests you. Do you love comedy? Sign up for an improv class. Find other artists like yourself who are new in town and embrace one another. You will need this. Create a family of weird, creative, supportive people. Sustaining work as an actor starts with the relationships you make with other artists. Everyone starts somewhere. Every big-name actor was an unknown at one point in his or her career. Building a successful career is not about getting in good with the people who are already established. It's about creating the next big thing with the people just like you. Do you know where Amy Poehler met Tina Fey? Improv class. Be a joiner. Day jobs and the importance of lying. When you are just getting started, especially the first year, you probably won't have 7 auditions a week. Thus, you probably won't be booking acting jobs. You will need to get a day job to pay your bills. My advice is to go ahead and look for that day job right away. Don't be like me. Don't sit around doing nothing, spending your nest egg. Get some income so you can save the nest egg and only spend little bits of it when necessary. If you have money coming in, You can use your nest egg to supplement times when you must quit your day job in order to take a low-paying acting job. The less you have to stress about money, the better. Getting a day job is a pretty standard part of any acting career. It doesn't mean you failed. Here are some of the jobs successful actors did to earn money in their early days. Johnny Depp was a telemarketer. Michelle Pfeiffer was a supermarket cashier. George Clooney, shoe salesman. Sandra Bullock, bartender. Eva Mendes was a fast food cashier. Jim Carrey was a janitor. Jennifer Aniston was a waitress. Hugh Jackman was a party clown. Tom Cruise worked as a hotel bellhop. Andrew Garfield, Starbucks barista. And Brad Pitt wore a chicken suit and danced in front of El Pollo Loco. Finding the right day job is an adventure all in itself. Be strategic about what kind of job you get. You will need one with flexibility. The best jobs for aspiring actors are night and weekend jobs. Hotel desk clerk, hotel bellman, valet, waiter, caterer, bartender, dog walker, tutor, tape logger, babysitter, all very popular jobs for actors. Or early morning positions, like a barista at a coffee shop, so your day is free by noon. Jobs like these keep your weekdays free for meetings, auditions, classes, and acting work. If you can't decide which day job to go for, don't worry. Chances are you will have many, many different day jobs. Part of this is because you might book an acting job and need to quit your day job or get fired to take the part. Or maybe it's because day jobs generally suck and you feel the need to shake things up. Most of the time, you're just scrambling to make money any way you can, whenever you can make it. I had countless day jobs. Most of my day jobs were office-related. Ironic, I know. Thanks to a mandatory typing class in high school, I can type 85 words per minute with 90% accuracy. I signed up at a temp agency in downtown Los Angeles. I took short-term office assignments to pay the bills. They paid better than minimum wage. I usually covered for secretaries and receptionists on vacation. Week-long assignments at most. I had boring jobs where I answered the phone and took messages, but I also had some really cool assignments. One time, I worked on the complaint line for a big-time soda company. It was my job to listen to people's complaints and then mail them coupons for free soda. Another time, I worked for a group of psychologists who performed psychological evaluations on people applying for high-ranking corporate jobs. My job was to transcribe their evaluations. It was fascinating. I supplemented my temping income by doing catering jobs on the weekends. Catering might be the best job an aspiring actor can get. Most catering jobs are evenings and weekends. The pay is decent, the work is easy. They almost always have leftover food you can eat at the end of your shift. If you attended a wedding reception at the Calamigos Equestrian Center in Burbank in 1997, there is a good chance I brought you your plate of chicken. And if you didn't like that chicken, you are crazy, because that chicken was good. I ate it every Saturday night for an entire year, and I never got tired of it. I tried to find every way to make money and still have time to pursue my dream of acting. I even worked as a telephone psychic for about a week. I saw an ad in the back of the LA Weekly. It said, "Are you naturally intuitive? Work from home as a telephone psychic." I called the number. This was my interview. Psychic job interviewer. "Are you naturally intuitive?" Me. "Sure, I would say I'm pretty intuitive." Interviewer. "Can you read tarot cards?" Me. "Yeah." Lie. Interviewer. "Great, here's your dial-in number. You can activate any time, 24 hours a day. Calls will be routed to your house. You work as much or as little as you want. Remember, the first 5 minutes of every call are free. Keep people on the phone longer than 5 minutes. You only get paid after the first 5 minutes. Got it?" Me. "Yeah." That was it. I was a telephone psychic. I went out and bought a book on astrology and one on tarot card reading. After skimming the books, I dialed in and activated my number. Calls started coming immediately. I did my best, but I wasn't very good at it. Mostly because of my MCG, Midwestern Catholic guilt. After 5 minutes, I felt compelled to remind people that their free minutes were up. Most would then hang up immediately. If they did stay on the phone, I felt horrible. The calls I received fell into two camps. Teenagers, who were probably going to get in trouble when their parents got the phone bill, and lonely old people. The longer these people stayed on the phone, the worse I felt. I did my best to be entertaining and positive. I think I often gave very good advice, but eventually I stopped dialing in, and I never collected my paycheck. It felt like dirty money. You should pick a day job you can quit with no consequences. I don't recommend working for a family member or a friend unless you're willing to piss them off when you skip your shift or miss a deadline at the last minute because you booked an acting gig. I also don't recommend working for a casting office or talent agent. You need a job you can sacrifice if it comes down to it. You came to be an actor, so you need to be able to cut the day job loose if needed. A lot of times people are hesitant to hire aspiring actors because they know you'll leave them in a lurch if a big opportunity comes along. So, here's the dilemma. Do you tell your day job the truth? Do you tell them that you are, in fact, not interested in being a data entry technician slash hotel clerk slash waiter, but that you are actually pursuing an acting career? Well, it depends. I always chose to be honest. I lost some jobs because of it. During my countless interviews, I would always tell them I was an aspiring actor and might need flexibility to attend auditions. Most of the time, the person would have to keep themselves from laughing. One time, a guy said, "Yeah, you and everyone else." And I said, "No, really, I'm doing it. I'm really doing it." And he said, "If you ever get an audition, we will deal with it, but I don't think it will be a problem." Wow, thanks for that. When I finally did get an audition and asked to leave early one Tuesday, he said, "Well, what happens if you get the job? How long will you be gone?" And I said, 2 days. And he said, "If you go on the audition, don't bother coming back." And I said, "Okay." And on Tuesday at 3 p.m., I left, and I didn't go back. Nor did I book the acting job. That's when I learned how to become a very good liar, which I rationalized by saying was a way to practice my acting skills. I still told the truth at my job interviews. I said I was an aspiring actor, but then I lied when I got auditions that interfered with my work hours. I found that jobs had no problem letting you miss a few hours for a doctor's appointment or other errands. Sure, you can leave early to pick up your sister at the airport, but they hated when you needed the exact same amount of time off for an audition. If I had an audition at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, I'd call into work at 9 a.m. and say, "Oh my God, I was just in a car accident. I have no car. It's being towed. My friend can bring me to work at noon. Is that okay? I'm so sorry." And then I'd get to work and complain about a headache from the accident just to make it convincing. If I booked a one-day acting job, I'd tell my boss that I needed emergency dental surgery and the only day they could see me was whatever day I was scheduled to shoot. If they pushed back, I'd cry. I'd say, "I couldn't sleep another night with the pain." Oh, man. Need a quick last-minute excuse, ladies? There's nothing better than a trip to the OBGYN. No one argues with you when you say you need to see the OBGYN. You start by saying you have an annual checkup and then follow up with procedures and additional testing if you book the gig. Am I ashamed of this? No. Did I use my gender to gain an advantage? Yes. Is it unfair because men can't do it? Yes and no. First of all, talk to me about fair when women start earning more than 70 cents to every man's dollar. And secondly, advice to the men out there, going to see your doctor for a prostate check is just as wonderfully vague and cringy as a woman's trip to the gynecologist. You can be sure you'll get out of work with no resistance. My cat ran away. My kitchen window was smashed with a rock in the middle of the night. My car got the boot, and I think my grandfather died like 4 times 1 year. To my bosses, I had the worst luck of any person on the planet. So I guess this is the section of the book where Jenna Fisher admits she's a liar. It's true. My lies were an essential part of staying employed while pursuing my acting career. But it wasn't just the lies that kept me employed. I'm also a very, very good worker. I always got my work done. I did it well. I was a valuable employee, which is an important part of the day job experience. Even though it's a temporary job, do it well. Avoid the temptation to be stingy and think you're saving your energy for your real job of acting. I'm a strong believer in the idea that abundance breeds abundance. You will be better prepared to give your acting career 110% if you're already working at that level at your day job. The Molly Shannon Story. Sometimes your day job becomes a path to something totally unexpected.